Got started last week on paper 14. We're ready for section 2, which is old single column, page 154. Okay. Let's see. So I guess just remind yourself that they as I mentioned, they start out giving you a little bit of sort of direct physical factual context, you know, so that you begin this journey of discovery of the central universe, you know, very solidly grounded. You're not imagining some fanciful, you know, fairyland. You know, it's very literal. You know, we talked about very literal things like the dark gravity bodies, and they pointed out to us that these 10 circuits of worlds that constitute the Paradise Havona system, 3 Paradise circuits, 7 Havona circuits, the physicality of those 10 circuits is so literal that just as in all things, that is a universal pattern source for all physical energy phenomena have a fundamental tenfold pattern woven through them, you know, that they are built upon. Maybe that's the best way to say it. You know, that's the foundation of the physical, that tenfold pattern. So that was a key point. And we're going to do a little bit more of that, some of that basic physical pattern, you know, issues. And then we'll start moving into to the rest of the story. So let's we'll kind of carefully pick our way through these first few paragraphs. I'll help to illuminate some of the physical details that they're bringing out.
2. Constitution of Havona. Spirit beings do not dwell in nebulous space. They do not inhabit ethereal worlds. They are domiciled on actual spheres of a material nature, worlds just as real as those on which mortals live. The Havona worlds are actual and literal, albeit their literal substance differs from the material organization of the planets of the 7 super universes.
So that little preface is giving you a restatement of something they said right up in the very beginning of our journey into the cosmology papers. You remember it in the preface of paper 11, I pointed out one of the most audacious statements in the whole revelation in terms of historical mystical thinking. All the intelligent creation of the Universal Father is domiciled on material abodes. Underline all. Including said Universal Father is domiciled on a material abode. Nothing is transcendent of matter. Not even the Father is transcendent of matter. That's how false historical thinking is. I mean, you know, the historical precedence is matter is the lowliest fact, and everything is transcendent of it. And anything that you, any relationship you have to matter should be despised, and you should be seeking to, you know, liberate yourself from this bondage and, you know, transcend matter. Well, to transcend matter is to transcend individuality. And then you are a drop of water in an ocean, and you are no more. I don't think that's what you want to achieve. Okay, by grace you've been initiated as an individual, and only through absolute free will action can you undo what God has joined together. The only way to realize that fallacy is iniquity. That's how wrong that is, and when you begin to study the nature of the totality of reality from a more unity perspective, You even begin to directly see what we're talking about here, that you can't transcend matter. From an eternity viewpoint, matter is what's transcendent. Normally, from our time viewpoint, we think of matter and spirit and the superadditive consequences mind. But from an eternity viewpoint, you have mind and spirit and the superadditive consequences matter. It's actually the transcendent fact from an eternity viewpoint. The Father has achieved transcendence by the very fact that He is able to stand on the aisle, that He has achieved an ascent of nature that allows Him to have a relationship to that transcendent substance of the aisle, and He can anchor Himself on it. I mean, that's a very revelatory viewpoint. If humans could take that on, that understanding, that truth, it would help a lot to temper the problems of spiritual consciousness when it starts to see itself as an end in itself, and the last thing it needs is individuality and matter, and it becomes a means of anti-materialism, sort of, you know. And just the anti is bad enough, but to see it as what that really is anti-individuality, anti-personality. I desire to no longer be. You don't want to go there. You don't want to be spiritual instead of religious. Okay. You want to be pure unity. You want to be an individuality that has opened the door of the top of its mind to engagement by unity. You want to have personal spiritual experiences, the kind of spiritual experiences that only an individual that has been personalized can have. If you depersonalize, or if you de-individuate and then hence depersonalize, you can't have a religious experience. You can't have a relationship with God. God is an absolute individual. And He proves that by the fact that He stands on the aisle, that He has a relationship with the aisle. To be godlike is to be able to stand on the aisle, to have an absolute relationship with individuality, to be grounded, to be unmovable, inconcussable. All those great words they use in the Revelation. Okay, so they're just, they reminded you the beginning of the story, even with the highest material fact, the aisle. This is the case. It's literal. And reminding you again, nothing's changed. we move out from the aisle. All these worlds, all 1,021,000,000 of them, are literal material abodes. It's fancy matter from our perspective. But for a Havona native, it's just dirt. It's a very matter-of-fact matter to them. Nothing fancy for them. Yeah. All right.
The physical realities of Havona represent an order of energy organization radically different from any prevailing in the evolutionary universes of space. Havona energies are threefold: super-universe units of energy matter contain a twofold energy charge, although one form of energy exists in negative and positive phases. The creation of the central universe is threefold, Trinity. The creation of a local universe directly is twofold, by a creator son and a creative spirit.
Okay, so note the last part there first, then we'll get into the kind of physics there at the beginning of that. To get you to just know, even though you can't directly understand anyway, but just know that in some very profound way, the reason that you call the Paradise Trinity a trinity, that you word, use the, a word that has the number three in it, and the fact that there's two creators that rule a local universe, you know, it's a universe of local universes, that rule a local universe, there's two of them, that literally is why material structures are dual. In the same way with the Trinity, why the material structures in the central universe are triune. Okay. Now, you know, it's not something simplistic that, well, the Creator Son builds half of the, you know, of the structure, and the Creator Mother Spirit builds the other half. It's not in that simple sense that forces it to be twofold. But it's just that patterns are universal. And, you know, we have a given domain, high and low, throughout that domain, in all ways, material, mindful, spiritual, you know, there are patterns that just pervade the whole expression. And so, you know, it's just, one of the reasons for them doing that is just to say, if you begin to try to contemplate the nature of the universe of local universes or the nature of the central universe, it doesn't matter if you start at the bottom and try to work your way up or start at the top and try to work your way down, it's threefold from both ends and all the way through. And the same way out here, it's twofold from both ends and all the way through. The highest personalized deity to the lowliest, you know, just dirt ball of matter, okay? It's twofold. It's a universal pattern in the whole regime, threefold and twofold. Okay, so that's, you know, they're trying to just encourage a less schizophrenic relationship between science and religion. You know, they're this one and the same thing. They're talking about the same domain. Just, you know, your starting points are different. Are you starting with the matter and working up, or the creator and working down? Okay, and then this neat little detail. Okay, so you fundamentally have this threefold energy system. You don't have to have any idea exactly what that means. That in some fundamental way, the structures, you know, be the atoms or whatever you want to think of, you know, the way the material forms are quantized, you know, individuated there in the central universe, they have a threefold internal nature, threefold symmetry to them, okay? Like a triangle, okay? There's a threefold symmetry to it in some way. And the pattern universe, the central universe, is the pattern for the local universes. And they're pointing out that what happens is this pattern is downstepped. You can't suddenly, you know, just have it be three, and then one of the folds of the threefold just disappears into the ether somewhere. Okay, it might get expressed in a different way, but it has to still be there in some way because it started threefold. It's like, well, what might happen? Well, I know that the central universe is a much more unity-like, much more spirit-like domain than here. I know I've got a lot of work to do to get more and more relationship to unity before I'm even allowed into the central universe. So I know it's fundamentally a more unity-like, spirit-like domain there. So you're definitely going to be going from unity to individuality as you downstep this pattern. And they're giving you some clues that, so I go, oh, I'm starting to see. So the fact that here, you know, notice how they were saying, you know, think about your atoms here. They have a nucleus and a system of electrons around them, around the nucleus. And they're reminding you that the way there's a relationship between the nucleus and the electron system is through a property that we call charge, you know, that has two signs, positive and negative. Okay, that electric charge link phenomenon, you don't have to even know what charge is, but just, you know, there's this electric charge phenomenon that keeps the electron system in association with the nucleus. And, you know, think about this cloud of electrons around a nucleus, a whole bunch of little individuations. That electron system is much more of an individuality sort of expression than the singularness of a nucleus, you know? So what they're trying to get you to envision is, I have some sort of a singular threefold construct. I downstep it, and there's a twofoldness there that in the nucleus, but one of the folds of the former threefold has become this more individuality-like expression of the electron system. Okay, and the way that it's related via this property you guys call electric charge, the way that it's related to that nucleus, the electron system and the relationship embody, all together embody that other fold of the former threefold, more unified system. That's the clue they're giving to you about the relationship between these two.
Yeah. You lost me.
Well, just.
I don't know if I'm alone. But.
Well, just if you just if you're looking for, I'm just saying. And again, you don't have to. I could give more definitive, but we have to get way into physics. We don't want to do that right here. Okay. Just in a way of thinking, I want to be able to. I know that somehow in Havona I can go 1, 2, 3. I can count three things somehow in Havona. I have to be able to count three things out here too. And the way you count it out here is nucleus 1, 2, electron system 3. Okay, that's where the three are. See, and just notice it's the two of it is still very kind of unity, this very tight harmony, like you expect all of, the totality of the Havona fact is. But one of the three facets has been loosened a bit and become more individuality-like so that it can engage the greater individuality of this domain. It's a less unity, more individuality-like domain. So it needs more modes of individuality engagement. It needs fingers. It can't just be a single, stump. It needs fingers. Just like when you go from Melchizedek to Vronodex to Lenonodex. You're going down from unity to individuality. And so when you read about the Lenonodex, they're not a very singular-like expression. There's all these different facets of Lenonodex, just like there's a whole bunch of electrons. You need a whole bunch of different flavors of Lenonodex because they have to engage individuality. There's more differentiation. You got to have a finger for that and a finger for that and a finger for that. You can't just have one finger. There's many things, and they have to all be touched, and they're different. Okay? So I have to have a thumb that's different than an index finger, that's different than a middle finger. I have to have a differentiation to engage the greater individuality. That's most fundamentally, philosophically, truthfully, why there's an electron system.
Is it correct to say that Havona would be a transition from unity to individuality? And that those circuits are more like a spiral. You could see it as a spiral of attenuations from unity to individuality, and that third part of that triune system is that the charge is what's left of that third one as it attenuates down into material.
You're starting to think along the lines. Technically what you have is to get down to where the rubber meets the road out here in the universe of local universes, there's a downstepping through two stages. There's three levels in the super universe and three levels in the local universe. The downstep from Havona, the central universe. There's unity, associativity, individuality, coming down through the super universe, headquarters, major sector, minor sector. And then it's repeated. Unity, associativity, individuality, a second stage of downstepping in the local universe. And that finally gets all the way down to where the rubber meets the road. So as an ascender, you're going up from the individuality of the local system through the associativity of the constellation to this first plateau of unity of the local local universe headquarters. And then you start anew in a transcendent way. You go up through individuality, a newfound individuality, newfound associativity, and a yet higher unity. And at that, so that, at that point, you've climbed up to the interface. And when you go into Havona, this thing flips. You've been going from individuality through associativity up to unity. And you get there, unity is your starting point. And then you go up through associativity to a new transcendent individuality. And it's a very long process through a billion world spiral staircase, okay, to a final step up to the highest of all individuality, the absolute of individuality, the Isle of Paradise.
What happened to unity?
What is now seems like the goal of everything becomes a new beginning. It's the ground floor in Havona.
Unity
is where you start, and you build a whole new unimagined individuality upon that unity foundation. See, because you're going from time to eternity. Like I was saying, I mean, from the eternity viewpoint, matter is transcendent. You know, individuality is transcendent. From the time viewpoint, you know, it's the starting point. Okay? So it's expressed very literally that you climb up through mind to spirit, and then you get into Havona, and you have a, you start with that spirit foundation, you climb up through mind to a whole newfound individuality. An individuality that's individuated in eternity, you know, a finaliter that stands as an individual in eternity. Not that can make it to eternity. Remember, you're in eternity to be on the aisle. You are individuated in eternity when you stand on the aisle. If you go there before you've climbed the whole spiral staircase of the central universe, that's why you have no experience if you go there. You're not an individuality in eternity. You're a nothing. Yeah. And that's what you experience. You experience nothing. No experiences at all. You have to individuate yourself in infinity, in eternity, in order to be there and experience.
That has something to do with the thought adjuster. I have something.
Right. See, and the only reason we could obviously ever hope to do such a grand thing is because we're given the seed for such transcendent individuality.
He's home.
Right. The thought adjuster embodies an individuation in eternity to begin with.
Right. So he's come home.
And then, you know, and it, through the mystery of mysteries, reaches down from that absolute individuation down to you, and then you just parallel it up. You follow it up. It's just a little clue for those who want to, you know, delve into physics. The more you know about what the pattern is for what you're observing, the more you might be able to figure out what it is exactly that you're observing. You know. And if I know that the electron system is not just incidentally related to the nucleus, I know that it really, you know, that the pattern, that the facet that it, that electron system represents is just like the other two facets on high. I know its separateness could be misleading. It's not as separate as it would initially appear. And you actually begin to discover that as you study an atom. You find that if you have an atom with lots of electrons, those innermost electrons really act as if they're part of the nucleus. See, because in the Havona, there aren't electrons. That part that we're experiencing as an electron system is, quote-unquote, part of the nucleus. All there is a nucleus. Okay. It's this very tightly, perfectly harmonized thing. And there's all kinds of interesting things, see, about when you start thinking about that relationship, how that two or three becomes two. You know, they mention it. Trinity goes to, duality, Creator, Son, Creator, Mother, Spirit. But we know that that duality is a pair of twos. The Creator, Son is Father, Son, and the Creator, Mother, Spirit is Spirit, Mother. So really, the key to getting 3 to 2 is it's really 4 to 2. Because there's four things actually in Havona. There's the threefold system because there's three infinite persons of the Paradise Trinity. But there's the Paradise Trinity that holds the three together. So you really have four things that are, split into pairs out here. That's how you get out here. So that should remind you that if you're going to fundamentally understand the physics out here, you need to have more than a father-like physics, more than a notion of just there's individualities and some mystical transcendent linkage between them. You have to recognize that there is a ubiquity. There's a whole that system is immersed in. There's a mother. And that fundamentally, a physics that doesn't recognize the existence of God the Mother is a false physics. Current physics begins with our initial initiated consciousness of God, the Father. And even though we've gone seemingly far afield with all sorts of atheistic, mystical physics, it still fundamentally is father-like physics, even though those physicists reject God the Father. It's the notion that it's fundamentally a universe of little parts that have some sort of mysterious linkage to them, okay? Rather than, there being a very definitive, sort of matrix, as it were, in which everything is immersed. And then it actually links things together. The first effort to try to somehow kludge that in is to make space and time substances that are finite and call it space-time and have this sheet, of space-time that you imagine now in general relativity, is something that's in between the objects, kind of a whole, see? The whole of space-time is attempting to bind everything together into one. But there is no such thing as finite curved space-time. But you could say, well, why do, if you assume that, does it kind of work? Well, because there actually is a whole and an individuality of that whole. There is God the Mother. And all the things of physics that are very direct reflections of her existence. It's like we were saying, it's twofold because it reflects that there's two creator beings. You can't separate. You have to think about it all together. You have to understand, you have to have a God concept and a physics concept together, or you have neither. That's what they're trying to get us to recognize. Okay? If your physics concept doesn't immediately allow you to understand that there's a Creator, Son, and a Creator, Mother, Spirit, it's a false physics. It can't be. Because if you believe that there's a twofold deity pattern in the local universe, you've got to see that everywhere. It's that much. In between the lines, they're trying to get you to just completely change your whole picture and let go of this schizophrenia between science and religion, and not be happy with your thoughts until your thoughts are unified between the two. Yeah.
So the first pattern of materialism is the Owl of Paradise.
The first pattern of matter. It's not an ism. It's not a complete lifestyle solution. You need mind and you need spirit and you need personality and you need deity. So it's not materialism.
Yeah.
See?
But
matter.
The first personality that he had to create something for his beings to have, to stand on. So he had to have the first Owl of Paradise and then we all have our different planets. But we wouldn't have had all that if he wouldn't have created the Isle of Paradise.
Yeah, that's a simple, basic starting point. Mm-hmm. But of course, it even goes beyond that. I mean, just. Yeah, but that's where you start. You know, you start with that easy point of, right, okay, everything has to have a place to stand. Nothing is magical. Nothing just floats in some ethereal space, okay? It's all literal. So that's a great reason to have matter, so that there's some place to be, you know? If I am, well, it's like, well, I have to be somewhere. Yeah, I can't just be Emmy nowhere. Okay? I have to be somewhere. And then you start to appreciate it a little more philosophically, that it's more than just the absolute of matter, the Isle. It is that, unqualified, it's the absolute of matter. But it's also the absolute of individuality.
Because of the ultimate times?
No, just because, you know, to go beyond matter, mind, spirit, where you're thinking of substances and energies, to think less... scientifically and more philosophically. Matter, mind, spirit, go up to the philosophical level, it's individuality, associativity, unity. Okay, that threefold pattern. And literally, because the Isle is the absolute of individuality, if the Father is going to give you a thought adjuster, there's this big reservoir that the Father is going to individuate this spirit fragment out of, cut it out of, however you want to think about doing that. Okay, pull it out of it, and it's not going to be, he's not going to throw you into the vat. Okay, that's not how you're going to get that relationship. He's going to take a little chunk out and hand it to you. He has to individuate part of it relative to the reservoir. He's cutting it out of, ladling it out of. He can't individuate without the Isle. Without the Isle, you try to dip the ladle in, and it couldn't penetrate the surface. It would be an unindividuatable rock-solid sheet. Because of the absolute of individuality, the ladle can individuate. Things are only individuated relative to the absolute of individuality. Without an absolute of individuality, there are no individuals. There's just the I am, all one blob. If you're going to separate it, there has to be something that there's separation relative to. You're going to individuate. There has to be an absolute of individuality. The Father is going to give you a personality. Now, an individuated measure of the total will reservoir that he can ladle out of. Okay? He can't make a personality, individuated will, except relative to the Isle. That's how that measure of will gets measured, gets individuated. If there's no absolute of individuality, how could he measure the size of what it is? If there was no absolute of individuality, there would be no rulers. There would be no measuring cups. There would be, there's no way to delineate anything from everything else. We all blend together as one. Ladle and that which is ladled, become one. The Isle is that fundamental, see, to this whole picture. It's what allows there to be separation. Okay, and the very first, and kind of getting back to the central universe, the very first expression of when these absolute facts of the three persons and the Paradise Trinity, their relationship to the Isle has an immediate expression of individuality potential. That the Isle, it's like the Isle is this absolute image, like, wow, think of what we can do now. Now we can individuate things. Let us do it. Let us make the pattern of individuality expression predicated on its potential to individuate. Let us make the central universe. The three of them have a relationship, see, to this absolute of individuality, and they do just that. They manifest an individuated expression. Three circuits for the three persons, and Havona for the Paradise Trinity. Four facts each have a consequence of their relationship. Okay? The Havona, the seven circuit of Havona, that's the Paradise Trinity's domain. The three circuits are the spirits, the sons, and the fathers. Yeah. Yeah. It's the billion worlds of the Paradise Trinity. Yeah. Yeah. And so if you're going to get into the door, you need a relationship with the Paradise Trinity. Just to the Father, Son, and Spirit is not going to do it. How do I get a relationship to the Paradise Trinity? There must be something that comes down from that very transcendent fact and meets me where I am so that I can begin to strike step with it and become like it. I can't magically just jump up to the Paradise Trinity, up at the infinite level. What is that fact that comes down? It's called the Mother. There's the Father, the Son, the Spirit, and the Mother. Yeah. Your relationship to the Mother is what really gets you that ability to walk into Havona and be there. Like you're saying, you have to have a relationship with the Trinity because it's a Trinity place. It's not the Father's place, the Son's place, the Spirit's place, it's the Trinity's place. Okay? Threefold, like you're saying. So that's why this recognition of the role of God the Mother and the consecration of your mind to that fact is so important. This distinction is vital. That's why we say that at the beginning of the group. And that's why they tell you that relationship to the Mother dominates your entire growth career through the local universe. I mean, the whole first leg is really about the Mother.
In a planet that has had a normal evolutionary career with the planetary prints and the atoms and so forth, because we've got such a revelation here in our hands, it's way beyond what most planets will get until they get into light and life levels. How do you suppose that they learn about God the Mother?
I mean, it's going to be in the early stages of a world. It's going to be very much a gradually phenomenon. Even on a normal world without rebellion and default, because remember what they tell you, they don't give those people a great breadth. They keep them very tightly focused on, well, let's just get this, and then let's all move to the next thing, and then it's a very methodical, long-term process. And so for all of the early stages of a world, those people wouldn't even begin to appreciate that bigger context until they start getting up in the local universe. Very much when you get to the constellation level, this starts to really be manifest when the Most High invites you to come and worship with Him. You don't worship God the Father. You worship God the Mother. But the farther you get along, especially if you think about it, even if it's sort of very, very methodical, you go through the civilizational uplifters of the planetary prince and his staff, and then the biologic uplifters, and then the philosophical uplifters, and then the spiritual uplifter. And then who do you have after the bestowal son? You have the Trinity teacher sons. Offspring of the Trinity come, to bring in that fourth fact, to really begin to bring that mother concept into play on the planet in a very manifest form, because you have the full potential for harmony now. The mother is the actuality of harmony of the threefold system. You need matter, mind, and spirit. You need an Adam and Eve, a magisterial son, and a bestowal son. To get you a solid relationship with the threefold actuality, and then the Trinity teacher sons come in to give you that harmony part, you know, that you have down here in this bottom block. Okay, the harmony that is the mother. The father's the potential for harmony. He gives you a personality, but he's not the actuality of harmony. She is. So you consecrate your will to the father, so you have the potential to be part of the cosmos, and then you consecrate your mind to the harmony, God the Mother, so that you actually are part of the harmony that is the cosmos. So, yeah, I mean, you know, once you start to understand this, I mean, so every time you see Trinity in the book, you see, you know you're talking about something that's has a lot more of a mother aspect directly involved. I mean, the Ancients of Days, when you start learning about it, you think, well, they sound like real father-like guys or something, you know? They must be direct offspring of the Father. No. The Ancients of Days are the offspring of whom? Trinity. The Paradise Trinity. No Father, Son, or Spirit involved in bringing them into existence. Their only parent is the Paradise Trinity. Okay? They are much more mother than you'd ever imagine, see?
Especially if they're going to be the ones that judge you.
Yeah, they seem so father-like to start with, because here we are in the local universe, and what's transcendent of the local universe? The super-universe level, okay, where the Ancients of Days are. So their relationship to us down in the local universe is very father-like, very transcendent, not immanent-like, okay? But once you're up there with them, you know, you're engaging them face to face, and you'll find that they're not as father-like as you imagine right now. They're actually very mother-like in nature. Okay? But not in a way that is literally expressed as a ubiquity, like the reflective mother spirits that are up there in the super-universe level. Yeah. But they do have their agents. Yeah, the creative mother agencies, the Ancients of Days, who are that ubiquity, that mind presence of the collective super universe level. Yeah. Allow the comments about Trinity, you know, and the fact, you know, we're about to read that, you know, who makes the Havona natives? The Trinity. Okay. This is all about the Trinity. This is all about the fifth epical revelation. This is about stuff that the first four epical revelations didn't even try to approach. This is about this whole new amazing recognition of that we live in a whole, and there's an individuality of that whole. And this distinction is vital, because we are only connected through that fact, through her. Initiated by him, you know, nurtured and wombed by her. Okay, a little bit more here about the physics.
The material of Havona consists of the organization of exactly 1,000 basic chemical elements and the balanced function of the seven forms of Havona energy. Each of these basic energies manifests seven phases of excitation, so that the Havona natives respond to 49 different sensation stimuli. In other words, viewed from a purely physical standpoint, the natives of the central universe possess 49 specialized forms of sensation. The Marantia senses are 70. The higher spiritual orders of reaction response vary in different types of beings from 70 to 210.
Okay, so the point here is to really recognize that, again, senses aren't what we've always thought of them. They're not material fundamentally. They're mindal. How many facets of mind do you have? That's how many senses you have. Okay? And so they're starting out, they're pointing out that that in Havona, like we mentioned, there's two sevens that we've already been exposed to. When we're going through the sacred spheres, you know, we were told that each one of those paradise circuits had seven worlds, that there was a sevenfoldness to each of those three circuits, and that sevenfold pattern is the same sevenfold pattern as the seven super universes, the seven master spirits, that sevenfold pattern. Okay, it's like, okay, I kind of understand that basically. That's not too mysterious. But then they tell you that there's another seven. Yeah, there's 10 circuits, but it's broken up into 3 and 7. So there's this other seven circuited Havona. And your first thought is, oh, well, that must just be another expression of the same seven. Here's where they're telling you point blank, no. That seven is orthogonal at right angles to, independent of, the seven master spirit sevenfold pattern. And that's literally, that philosophical orthogonality, independence, is literally manifest in the structure of the central universe. The seven master spirit pattern goes around a circuit, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, at right angles to the circumference, the radius, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 circuits of Havona. Those are independent sevens. Okay? And so, like they're saying, you have the radial 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of Havona. You have seven different forms of energy associated with those seven circuits out of the 10 forms of physical energy. Seven are associated with those seven circuits. So there's a sevenfold differential, seven circuits. And then that pattern, that transcendent pattern in the central three, is imposed, casts a shadow out onto those seven, you know, kind of breaking it into seven radial shadows. Okay? That sevenfold pattern casts upon the seven circuits.
And that extends out to the super universe.
Yeah, right, and it does, yeah. But you know, in the central universe then, so if you actually move around in the billion worlds, there's 49 different regions. On each of the seven circuits, there's seven different shadow regions. There's seven different flavors, you know, on each circuit, and there's seven circuits, so there's 49 different flavors. See, if they were the same seven, you couldn't take 7 times 7 to get 49. Okay? It would be just 7. And 7 again, and yeah. But when you multiply them like that, it means they're orthogonal. See, you have...
I don't know what that word means.
It just means at right angles, too. It means, I mean, when you make a plot where y-axis is vertical and x-axis is horizontal, okay? That's because those are independent variables. You can move it. You can change turn this knob and it doesn't affect this knob. Or you can change this knob and it doesn't affect this knob. Or you can change both and then it makes us, you know, Etch-a-Sketch pattern around in the thing, okay? The Etch-a-Sketch has two knobs because one of them moves only like this and one of them moves only like this. Those are orthogonal knobs. They're perpendicular to each other. They're at right angles to each other. They're independent of each other. So that's why you have these 40. So they have 49 different energy phases that can relate to things, and so they can experience things in 49 different ways.
And so it's not like a record platter, so they're going at different speeds.
Well, I mean, there's all that, you know, but just see the fact that you have this literal expression in the structure of the central universe, they're pointing out, see, just like we were saying above, they have that internalized in their minds, too. Their minds have 7 times 7 phases to them. And so they can see like this and see like that and see like this and see like that times 47. Okay? There's 47 different ways that they can sense, 49 different ways that they can sense things. Yeah, too many sevens, sorry. Okay, and it's just simply the mathematics, because you have two, you know, sevens multiplied together. You go out in the Maranja. Okay, Maranja's substance, this artificial substance that, that bridges the gap between spirit substance and matter, between a unity substance and an individuality substance, between a substance that has a fundamental sevenfold, the spirit, and a substance that has a fundamental tenfold, the matter. And those are independent of each other. So one of the seven can connect it all ten. The second of the seven can connect all ten. There's 70 different ways to associate seven and ten. So there's 70 different phases, 70 different flavors of sensing that are possible in that associative domain of Maranja.
Okay. Where are you getting the 10 from?
Because all material things are tenfold. Like and see, so what happened? This is kind of interesting. See, those Havona natives, they're just Havona natives. They're not central universe natives. They're Havona natives. They only have a relationship to seven of the 10 circuits. But out here, the whole of the central universe is expressed. The whole 10 is out here. So instead of 7 to 7, like in there, we have 7 to 10. So instead of 49, we have 70 out here, see, in the Maranja. And then they're just pointing out that you can bring in a third independent variable in terms of which of the three absolute persons, or infinite persons even, you could say, you know, is casting a transcendent shadow on it. So you can have 70 times 3 for 210. You can go all the way up to 210, see, like they're saying. Okay. Okay. And you actually, you know, if you read paper 36 about the life carriers right at the beginning there, they point out a very interesting fact that life has this fundamental threefold imposed on it, so that you have Father, Son, and Spirit-like beings. And they tell you an amazing thing, that there are literally worlds, separate worlds, for those three different flavors. It's like, whoa, they didn't mention that anywhere else in the book. So, you know, so in other words, I can go around Nebadon, and there's three different kinds of worlds, depending on whether or not these beings are part of the hierarchy coming down from the Father or the Son or the Spirit. You know, and then once you get down from the three, then there's 7 and 12 and, you know, et cetera. There's all this branching. Okay. But that's one point in the book where they're reminding you that obviously there's going to be the potential to get 70 times 3 in play too, if you have a being that spans all of these possible variations. You know, they've got Father, Son, Spirit. They've got all seven master spirits. They've got all 10 circuits of the central universe. They have phases of their mind that embody all those different combinations. And so they have 210 different ways they can sense things. Yeah. Now, just as a footnote, remember they tell you something revelatory. We have 12. The average mortal sensory pattern is 12. And that's a little reminder of what I said right up front. Don't think about senses like we've tended to. It's like, well, okay, this is one sense I can touch. This is another sense. I have eyeballs and I have ears. And yeah, you know, your ears aren't sensing anything. They're just jiggling. Yeah. Okay, your mind is sensing. Yeah. Okay.
So when are we going to get access to the rest of them?
You have it all right now. I mean, the thing is to challenge yourself to stop thinking so materially about your consciousness. You know there's a God. Why? Because you sense it internally. It's an inner experience. It isn't just some magical belief, if it has any, you know, substance to it. Okay? You know, if I say, I know there's a God, it's like, well, how do you? Well, because I've experienced the fact of God in my mind. It's like, well, if you've experienced something, you have some sort of sensory organ. Well, not an organ. I have a phase of my mind that can sense that. It's not the phase of my mind that does eyeball stuff or ear stuff or tongue stuff or finger stuff. Okay? There's all, we have different ways of sensing. And they're really all on the same footing in our mind. And the ones that aren't forced to also be in very tight relationship with very crude material things like our vision and our hearing stuff are actually, see, capable of more refined sensing. They're not as coarse because they're less individuated. They're more unity-like. Those other senses, the other seven, okay, have potential for sensing very subtle things like still small voices. Okay? Something that your eyes, your ears, your tongue would never sense. Okay? But one of those 12 senses, you know, allows you to sense. And we usually use these kind of, we say, I hear a still small voice. Well, you don't actually hear it. You sense it with one of these different ways of sensing that your mind has.
Nothing jiggled.
Yeah, nothing jiggled.
Yeah, the question everybody here wants to ask, what the hell are the 12?
Yeah, well, just start thinking about, you know, different things that you believe you know, that you've experienced, and how did you get access to that?
Sensory sensitivities.
Yeah. You know, I can be deaf, dumb, and blind, you know, and I can still know God.
Three cosmic intuitions.
Well, yeah, see.
Three.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. See,
we're getting closer.
But see, of course, now there's going to be a million different ways you can rationalize this. And so that's the tricky part. I mean, the first thing that you want, before you start trying to count to 12, maybe you should try to figure out what 12 means. Okay, and that, you know, like I said, I mean, I've just now deduced where 12 comes from. You know, 7, that's easy. 10, that's easy. Okay, 12 is very tricky. You have to unpack the central universe. You have to understand the central universe. Following from their suggestions. You know, they tell you many points that this is 12-fold and they don't tell you why it is or how it came to be. You got to put all the pieces together and figure out what that is. And in the wake of figuring out what the source of 12 is, now you might ask, okay, so how might I have 12 senses that match that 12-fold pattern? It's not just numerology. You know, you don't just find 12 things and rationalize them. Okay, that's numerology.
We don't take it in Havana, 12. We actually take it into.
We'll have a lot. We'll have more than 70 by the time we go into Havana. You know, but then, so you know, or maybe we do. You could wonder that and say, well, actually, am I going to have a downgrade in the number? I mean, what if I never had more than 70? What if I've got 70 going up to the local universe? Let's say. Let's just imagine, even though I don't know what the heck I'm talking about, as I go through the super universe, I somehow keep the 70. Maybe I don't gain anymore, but I at least keep the 70. Well, I go from Uversa to Havona, and I perforce have to go to 49. Oh, so it's not all about quantity. Well, that's a lesson. Maybe 49 of a higher quality is better than 70 of a lesser quality. Right. See, just to think about that is to challenge us to not think so materialistically, so quantitatively about ourselves. I'm better than you because I can count 12 senses and you can only count 5. Well, I mean, if they use one of their senses well, that may trump all 12 of your mediocre usages. Okay. you know, it's not how brilliant you are, it's how ignorant you aren't. Okay. Yeah, to be less ignorant is to be using input from all these senses, not just from the eyes and the ears. Okay, that's to finally transcend ignorance. Now, to know that there's a God, not believe there's a God. You know it because you've sensed it, you've experienced it, just like this. Okay, I don't believe there's an arm on this couch. You know.
We know that our thought adjusters, and we know that the midwayers do make contact. So I was just thinking that we might apply that to these senses that we're not overtly conscious of, and yet they're life-changing.
Or just, you know, think a simple example where the fact that there's more than the five is manifest. You take an improved material form like we have. It's called a material son or daughter. Okay? And they have a much more conscious engagement of these other senses. And some of those other senses allow them to see midwayers and seraphim and Lenonendex and Melchizedex. And I mean, see, that's using some of the senses that, you know, are too limited in us to be able to see a midwayer, you know, let alone a Melchizedek. But, you know, they have it. So it's not that they have something that we don't have. It's just that they have it upstepped from what we have. Okay? And, you know, as you go in deep into light and life, the mortals on that world, you know, all these senses have been upstepped, and they can see, quote unquote, see with those other senses, and they can see the angels and stuff too. Okay? But the flip side is what I was saying before. Just, you know, the very fact that you can't see all the stuff that might be going on in this room with all these higher senses, it's like, oh, if only I... No, there's a positive side. Because your consciousness is not cluttered with, you know, billions of angels, you know, bouncing around in this room, okay, it allows you to hear a still small voice inside. There's no clutter that you have to filter out in order to hear the still small voice. You know, none of us have the refined sense to pull the adjuster's still small voice out of a cacophony of angels all around us. Okay? So there's a reason why we don't have that much awareness right now. We don't have the sophistication of mind to filter that all out and sort out all that. Okay? Too much input. You know, we'd be overwhelmed.
This is on the first sphere of light and life, and I wanted to ask you about this today. So we've moved into this, so no. I'm going to take this opportunity. It's paper 55, spheres of light and life, administrative readjustments. And this is the first stage of light and life. And it says, such changes have already been made in the range of human vision as enable mortals to recognize these heretofore invisible cousins of the early Adamic regime, the midwayers. This is made possible, this is the part right here, this is made possible by the final discoveries of physical science. See, we have, our science has evolved to the point that we can develop something that helps us to see the midwayers, but also, this is made possible by the final discoveries of physical science in liaison with the enlarged planetary functions of the master physical controllers.
Right.
So it's a
collaboration. But again, see, the physical science thing, that's, you know, our bodies will be more like material son and daughter-like bodies. They'll have, you know, we'll have genetically engineered mankind to the point where basically we have the same biologic makeup as a material son or daughter, you know, absence the connection to the tree of light and life and all that sort of stuff. But just, you know, they're trying to point out it's all very physical. Remember the clues they give you in the book about just how physical spirit energy is, really, when... You know, like I said, I mean, there's science that's matter, mind, and spirit. Okay, that's science. Okay, that's not religion because the spirit's there. That's just science. It's another energy. Okay, and I mean, literally, we have glands. You know, mortals have variations of a glandular nature that affect how much relationship that mortal can have to spirit energy. It's that scientific. It's that literal. Okay, so obviously you can upstep the DNA and improve your relationship to mind energy and spirit energy, because it's all science. It's a threefold science.
And how do those glands that are more receptive to spirit energy?
Not the glands. So they do something to the system to make you holistically somehow more sensitive. See, they get, you know, the higher the mindal facet. Or going all the way up to spirit energy, the more it has to be a holistic receptor. It has to be a more unity-like receptor in order to sense it. See? So these higher senses are less individuated. Yeah, we know the five very individuated ones, very intimately. The ones that we don't know about, so you're going to more holistic, more unity-like ones.
None of the physical beings of the central universe would be visible to your ancients. Neither would any of the physical stimuli of those faraway worlds excite a reaction in your gross sense organs.
So even the ones we don't know about are still gross, okay, relative to Havona, just a reminder.
If a Urantian mortal could be transported to Havona, he would there be deaf, blind, and utterly lacking in all other sense reactions. He could only function as a limited, self-conscious being deprived of all environmental stimuli and all reactions thereto.
Okay, so now remember, you know, we use gross flippantly. I mean, gross is, you know, it means coarse. Yeah. You know, there's gross and refined, you know, coarse and fine. Okay, it just means, you know, it has to be a large glob before we know it exists. You know, we just don't pick up on the fine details in any sort of immediate fashion. Even with our more refined ones that we're kind of unconscious of or haven't really stopped to notice, they're saying your most refined sense would be completely blind there. There's everything is so much more unity-like there, so much more fine-grained that you could not, you know, remember, the only reason we can sense things is because, you know, great big glob called cup separated from bigger glob called table, okay? But can I see the molecules in the table? No. I don't have that resolution. I can't, my senses are too coarse to resolve such fine, yeah. And see, everything is very fine-grained, you know, in Havona. You have to have, right, you have to have very precise senses to distinguish that from that. Because from our, you know, like they're saying, I mean, even if it wasn't just blackness, which is what it would be if you went there, if you imagined somehow them visualizing something, you know, having master physical controller somehow make it visible to you, okay, instead of seeing a uniform blackness, you'd see a uniform whiteness, okay, is what your visualization would be, because you don't, it's all too fine-grained for you to even differentiate. All the worlds and beings and everything all would all be blurred together into just a unity to you.
They could have used any native world for an example here, probably. Would have been the same
yeah,
case.
Yeah.
Light and life worlds, same.
Yeah, and just one more before I forget. So, again, this is another tie back to the aisle, just like we, you know, we're done with this little bloxy of paragraphs now. It started and ended the same way. It's like, just like the aisle was literal and you stand on it, so is the central universe. And just like if you were to be taken to the aisle, you'd have zero experiences, same thing here. It's so transcendent, it doesn't matter how spiritual you think you are. You're not even remotely spiritual enough to have any experience there. You know? And so if you have some sort of very transcendent experience here because of you get, you know, close to your adjuster in some way or something, you know, or maybe you ask and you're granted a request to, you know, show me paradise, Lord. I guess they probably won't go crazy. Let's just give them a quick flash. And instantly you're in infinite black void and you're really scared. Like, okay, I'll come back. See, because, yeah.
Careful what you ask.
Right. If you think you've been shown paradise and then that wasn't your experience, see, actually being put into eternity, which is where paradise is to be put into infinity. And you have no experiences of infinity. It'll be an infinite nothing that you'll feel, quote unquote. If you actually said, show me something, and you see a wonderful land of, you know, flowers and brooks, and okay, that's not paradise. That's got to be real close. Something's pretty close. That's not very transcendent, because you can you can sense something.
Then there was John the Revelator.
Right. See, so you know he didn't go all the way to paradise. Okay. Yeah, he was, you know, the farthest he was shown was the local universe headquarters, was Salvington. Okay. And that's not so transcendent that he didn't just experience, you know. Okay, he experienced something.
Test pattern.
Right. But it, yeah, if they were to show you Havona, it would be nothing. That's what Havona looks
really
like.
Really profound though.
Yep, a very profound nothing.
You were talking about the grain of Havona, but the extent of our ability to our granularity in this life is the master spirit, right? The cosmic mind, right? I mean, we can't.
Yeah, but way downstepped at this point still. You know,
right.
You know? Right. It's still, I mean, the three cosmic intuitions are still very coarse at this point. You know, they'll start to have a measure of refinement when we have, you know, Maranja mind. Then you'll kind of liberate those three cosmic intuitions, you know, from their limitations right now. But you know, they are certainly transcendent of our agitated mind, and they will, you know, if you actually begin to engage them, they will have a greatness to them that will be startling. It's like, wow, look what I see. This is self-evident. I see the whole picture, and it's self-evident now. You know, so it's a, you know, it is a refinement, you know, in definitely relative terms. But okay, all right. So that's kind of the physics. So in terms of the constitution of Havona, yeah, that's grounding our relationship to its constitution, the literalness of its constitution. How else is it constituted?
There are numerous physical phenomena and spiritual reactions transpiring in the central creation, which are unknown on worlds such as Urantia. The basic organization of a threefold creation is wholly unlike that of the twofold constitution of the created universes of time and space. All natural law is coordinated on a basis entirely different than in the dual energy systems of the evolving creations. The entire central universe is organized in accordance with the threefold system of perfect and symmetrical control. Throughout the whole Paradise Havona system, there is maintained a perfect balance between all cosmic realities and all spiritual forces. Paradise, with an absolute grasp of material creation, perfectly regulates and maintains the physical energies of this central universe. The eternal Son, as a part of his all-embracing spirit grasp, most perfectly sustains the spiritual status of all who indwell Havona. On Paradise, nothing is experimental. And the Paradise Havona system is a unit of creative perfection.
Okay, let's just think about that a little bit. And in the context of one little tidbit up above that we didn't bring out yet. Okay, so notice here, the basic organization of a threefold creation is wholly unlike that of the twofold constitution of the created universes of time and space. Okay, so... And what's the pretext that they gave you for that statement? Up there, they said that the material of Havona consists of the organization of exactly 1,000 basic chemical elements. See, and the balanced function of the seven forms of Havona energy. Okay, so, yeah, there's that seven we talked about, you know, of the seven circuits. Okay, but there's also a chemistry there. And, you know, there's this basic organization of a threefold creation is wholly unlike. So you have, they're trying to point out to you again that you've got to think about two things. You can't just think about a quantity difference. It's like, oh, we have 100 elements and they have 1,000. Yeah, there's that differential. But on, you know, the first thing that we talked about already is their chemistry isn't electron chemistry. Basically the difference between physics and chemistry here on Earth, you know, the two branches of studies, when you're studying chemistry, you're studying what the electrons of the atoms do. And if you're studying physics, you're studying what the nucleus does. Nuclear physics, okay? You know, electron chemistry. And chemistry is often about just the outermost electrons to boot, okay? The very superficial part. If you penetrate below the surface, then it's physics, okay? But if it's just what the surfaces do is they bounce off each other, that's chemistry, okay? But there's, you know, but they're saying, you know, remember, yeah, it's not like that here. You know, here physics and there isn't a difference between physics and chemistry in Havona. Okay, there isn't that differential between the more unity-like and the more individuality-like of chemistry. It's all one, but they're still called chemical elements. In other words, you still have molecules and, you know, structures. Okay, it isn't just a gas of a thousand atoms, okay. You have worlds, and you know. So there's a chemistry to this, and it's a very interesting chemistry, because again, it's not a chemistry that exists in a schizophrenic relationship with religion. Okay, the matter and the spirit energy are intimately involved in all chemistry. The chemistry there is not just material. It's also spiritual and then everything in between. And that's why in one paragraph here, this last paragraph we read, you know, they point out to you that you have this control of the aisle, but equally you have the control of the spirit energy by the absolute spirit, you know, the literal substance, centerness of the second source and center, the absolute spirit, okay, not really as the eternal sun, per se, but just as the absolute spirit, like it's the absolute of matter. These two things are on equal footing there. And in order for this threefold energy system to be what it is, they have to be on equal footing. The whole chemistry there is dependent upon both the absolute of individuality and the absolute of unity. Here, see, especially when you go just to chemistry, it's very much about the most individuated aspect of the atom, the most Isle of Paradise-like part of the atom. And really not much at all. You know, you can completely ignore unity. Okay? It's just become stoichiometry and stuff, you know, about counting individuality. Okay, so he said that's what's between the lines there. So you can say, well, maybe the reason you need 1,000 elements is because only then do you have the ability to engage the fullness that is unity and have them be together in this magnificent harmony that we can't even imagine. Okay. Now, and it's like, well, why is there 1,000? Well, if the unity is very much like the unity of the Trinity, it's the Trinity's place, okay, and from a bottom-up point of view, we think of the Paradise Trinity as being the super-additive consequence of the relationship between the three infinite personalities, okay? I mean, that's why there's 1,000 elements. The physical is tenfold, but there's three, yeah? So 10 times 10 times 10 is why there's 1,000. There's 10 times 10 times 10 so that it can have a relationship with the Trinity directly. It takes all three. Okay. And so that's why there's... You know, out here, we just have 100 elements because it's 10 times 10. Because it's dual out here.
Duh.
Okay.
It's like, duh.
Okay.
They've
going to be pretty harmonious in the central universe.
Right, and probably the whole notion of atoms and everything kind of breaks down. But anyway, right. So that, see, adds to it. You know, it's not all just, okay, really complicated physics. You know, it's a physics that's now complicated enough that it can have this direct relationship with spirit. It's like the adjutants engaging you. Initially, only the most matter-like adjutant can engage, you know, you as a single-celled organism. The more sophisticated the physics becomes that is your body, you know, and then eventually very focused on your brain, the more sophisticated that physics becomes. It finally gets so sophisticated that the seventh adjutant can engage it. An adjutant, a mind adjutant that can directly interface with the unity that is spirit. See, and that, see, you're seeing a similar pattern here. You have the requisite complexity of matter so there can be this very intimate association with spirit. Okay? That the first adjutant, the second adjutant, the third, et cetera, are not capable of. So if you want a greater relationship with spirit, greater relationship with unity, take the light in cultivating, you know, a more holistic mind, a more seventh adjutant-like encompassing mind. Otherwise, your relationship to spirit is mere delusion, basically, you know, and perhaps a tiny little bit of grace. You know, because of course we all start with a little bit of grace because we need it. That whole bit about you can't just consecrate your will. You know, no amount of will can make the first adjutant connect to the Holy Spirit. You got to consecrate your mind to be something that can engage spirit.
How do you do that?
Well, that's a long subject of supplying the favorable conditions.
I want to know how you do it.
Well, again, you know.
Does anybody have an answer?
No, you can't. There is no. If someone thinks they has an answer, they're delusional. Okay. I mean, you have part of the picture. I mean, the only way to have the answer to that is this revelation. I mean, all of it. Now, there's ways, places you can start. You can start by thinking about some of the philosophy of Rodin.
Okay,
you can.
Thinking.
You can. Is it your feelings that lead you Godward? No, it's your thoughts.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
It's your thoughts, not your feelings. So you start, see, that's what I'm saying, you consecrate your mind. It's your thoughts that lead you Godward. And there's inroads to that. Rodin is an example of an inroad to that. Some of the private discourses of Jesus, you know, discourse on reality, discourse on time and space, you know, some of the discourse on the mind. Those are inroads. So you're trying to get into philosophy. I mean, the key is philosophy.
Okay.
Philosophy is the gateway. And or they introduce the three fundamental intuitions that give you the structure in which a philosophical mind can exist. And then they have a three-section essay. That three-section essay, paper 16, sections 7, 8, and 9, okay, that's a good place to start. The answer to the question, well, how do you do that? How do you consecrate your mind? It's beginning to develop a relationship with a philosophy which can be lived rather than merely a religion that can be believed. Okay? Philosophy connects your religious, inner religious life with the outer life where perforce your feet must tread. You can't just curl up into your inner life. Okay? Yeah. You need something that can relate the science of what your feet walk on. Expand your notion of science. Science means knowledge. Doesn't mean, you know, counting things. Okay, science means knowledge. You have to connect knowledge to personal spiritual experience, and only philosophy can relate those two. So that you can bring your inner life out into the outer life. And philosophy is something you can live. Philosophy is a relationship to truth. Yeah, and you can live it. It will, you know, you can say, you know, you can follow the advice that Jesus gave us. It's like, well, You know, Jesus, you know, why am I having such difficulty? Is it because I know not the truth? He said, no. No, the heathen know not the truth. That's not your problem. Your problem is you obey not the truth. It's like, well, why don't I obey it? Because you haven't figured out how to develop a philosophy that actually is in the domain of truth where you can follow it. To obey the truth, you have to have a way to obey the truth. You can't just declare, I now obey the truth. You have to construct a way to bring your inner life out into the outer life so that by your fruits, they will know you. You know, you may have this wonderful inner life, but no one can look at that. All they can see is what manifests overtly. And if you have no philosophy, what manifests overtly is really a poor example of what's probably on the inner life. You have, so you don't just need the spiritual fruits, those single words. You need the cosmic fruits of the Spirit. See, those are ones where you've developed a philosophy that can bring the inner life out, so that people can see the real you. If you have no philosophy, they can't see the real you. You can declare it all you want. And it's like, words are cheap. Show me that you live truth. Show me something besides the soap opera that I'm familiar with, okay? Show me a philosophy of living, not just a religious belief. Show me the fruits of the Spirit. Okay? And that's why we have a philosophical revelation, to help us to get the inner life that Jesus came to uplift, sort of establish an inner life in man. This is to help us to get our inner life out so that it can better our day-to-day lives and civilization in general.
It's the coming out of the fourth
festival. Yeah, it's... The fifth is the coming out party. Yep. All right. Let's see. Where in the heck were we? Let's see.
In the spirit of the age.
So,
that's right.
There's that one. So we ended on paradise. Nothing is experimental. Remember how they started out this thing about commenting about this life we live out here is an experiment. It's a test. Okay. So there's still a test in play. In the central universe, you're trying to get to the point where you've completed the test and become a finaliter on paradise. Okay? All the way up to that, you've got this experimental, experiential life being tested. Do you have the metal to be a finaliter?
The universal spiritual gravity of the eternal sun is amazingly active throughout the central universe. All spirit values and spiritual personalities are unceasingly drawn inward towards the abode of the gods. This Godward urge is intense and inescapable. The ambition to attain God is stronger in the central universe, not because spirit gravity is stronger than in the outlying universes, but because those beings who have attained Havona are more fully spiritualized and hence more responsive to the ever-present action of the universal spirit gravity pull of the eternal sun. Likewise does the infinite spirit draw all intellectual values paradiseward. Throughout the central universe, the mind gravity of the infinite spirit functions in liaison with the spirit gravity of the eternal sun, and these together constitute the combined urge of the ascendant souls to find God, to attain deity, to achieve paradise, and to know the Father.
So there's another example of what do I have to be like to have a relationship with Havona? I can't just be spiritual. I know the first paragraph points out, okay, well, you need to be spiritual in a way that you can't even imagine yet. Okay, yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, the reason is you don't feel spirit gravity out here like you feel material gravity is because you don't have much spirit substance to be pulled on, for the absolute of spirit to tug on. Okay, but in there, You know, you will. By the time you get there, you'll have built up enough spirit substance that you actually can feel a very definitive pull. Okay? But notice immediately they add to that. You know, what's going on in there is a liaison between the absolute spirit and the absolute mind. Okay? So you have to be said liaison. You know, your mind and your spirit need to be one, need to be a conjoint expression. See, again, a reminder of how much you need to work on this consecration of mind and building up a mind that is in liaison with spirit so that the two become less and less easy to distinguish. Okay? Like I said, you spend the whole local universe career trying to just get the initial amount of mind built up in intimate liaison with spirit relative to that initial initiation of spirit that the Father gave you. It takes you the whole local universe career, they tell you, really to kind of catch up with the amount of spirit that you're not in sync with yet. Got a lot of mind building to do. And then once you get something that's more on par, okay, then you're working in the super universe career. But it takes you the whole local universe career to kind of catch up with that initiation that the Father gave you. That spirit, he's your spiritual father, remember, not your mindal father. He's just your spiritual father. So he gives you the spiritual initiation, and it takes you a lot of effort to catch up mindally. It's like, okay, now I've kind of got the whole thing going. Yeah, now you can do what you do in the super universe in preparing for Havona, where you kind of leave the local universe, you have sort of an equal measure of mind and spirit. Now you're going to work on really getting them in intimate liaison, really together. And then you can get into Havona. So that's some of the in between there. You know, just constantly think about this in a very literal way, like they keep emphasizing. It's not just, well, facts about Havona I have to memorize. You know, they're trying to get you to think very literally. It's like, well, what do I have to do to get an entrance pass there? What do I have to be like? You know, this is as much about you as it is about the constitution of Havona. And for you to be going to Havona, you have to have the constitution of Havona, see? To see the title of this section differently, to turn it around. It's not so abstract. You know, this is about the constitution that you should be striving for, to become Havona-like, where the matter and the spirit are together in this magnificent harmonious system. Mind and spirit are in intimate liaison. That's what you should be striving for.
You have to do something.
Yeah, as well as be something, yeah. Can't just be the spirit fact that the Father initiated. Yeah, yeah. There was a hand somewhere, wasn't there?
It was me.
Oh, is it you? Okay. You okay? All right, okay. All right. So, all right, one little tidbit in here that they throw in, this final paragraph.
Havona is a spiritually perfect and physically stable universe. The control and balanced stability of the central universe appear to be perfect. Everything physical or spiritual is perfectly predictable, but mind phenomena and personality volition are not. We do infer that sin can be reckoned as impossible of occurrence, but we do this on the ground that the native free will creatures of Havona have never been guilty of transgressing the will of deity. Through all eternity, these supernal beings have been consistently loyal to the eternals of days. Neither has sin appeared in any creature who has entered Havona as a pilgrim. There has never been an instance of misconduct by any creature of any group of personalities ever created in or admitted to the central Havona universe. So perfect and so divine are the methods and means of selection in the universes of time that never in the records of Havona has an error occurred. No mistakes have ever been made. No ascendant soul has ever been prematurely admitted to the central universe.
See? How do they end it? Yeah, I've been talking about all these requirements. See, that's the bottom line. So you can go back, oh, that's what this was all about. So you can go back and rethink, ah, this is about my constitution, not its constitution. Okay, and I wanted to just point out so that, you know, as you, no matter where you're reading the book, remember how precisely you can take their words. When they use the prefix MIS, like when you're in kind of about two-thirds of the way down in that paragraph, it says, there has never been an instance of misconduct. You know, that mis prefix literally means wrong, you know, as in right and wrong, that kind of, not right and wrong, like wrong answer to a question. That's not actually wrong. You know, it's the incorrect answer to the question. No, literally, as in moral, right and wrong. Okay. So no one has ever grabbed a hold of badness, cluelessly. Okay. Nothing has been wrongly taken. And then they just take it up another notch. At the end, you have kind of repeating that, no mistakes. Remember, evil is mistaken judgment, wrongly taken judgment. You know, and they said there had never been sin. But not only has there never been sin or evil, there hasn't even been error. Not even one smidgen of error. Well, even Melchizedek's occasionally make an error. Never evil or sin, but occasionally even Melchizedek's make an error. Ah, it couldn't get into paradise. I mean, into the central universe, let alone paradise. Okay. You have to be beyond the ability to ever even make an error, ever, of the tiniest measure, in order to get into Havona. Okay? See, so, you know, just put it in real definitive terms so that you don't have, you know, some sort of a fanciful notion about where you are. You know, we're a long ways away from this, you know? How many times did Steve go, wow, when they, yeah, right. You know, we need to be very patient and not be delusional about where we are. We have a long journey ahead of us to slowly, step by step, work through all of the facets of ourself and master it so that it's not ever capable of even an error, you know, and then we can get into Havona. Remember one of the ways that they express that milestone, you know, the what you have to have achieved to get into Havona is perfection of purpose. You know, that consecration of your will to the perfect will of God the Father, you've done that in order to get into Havona. Okay? You have to, there's no, by the time you get there, there's no blockage between the will to have a purposed self and the purposed self. You've got a nice, there's no blockage, you know, the will manifests as a definitive purpose. You have perfection of purpose. Okay? But that's, again, just the beginning. The Father's just the initiator. You complete the task that the Father gave you. You've initiated now. Because that's your relationship to the Father is a relationship to an initiator. It's like, well, what have I initiated? If I've completed the Father leg to get me into Havona, I must be doing the mother part when I go into Havona. Yeah. Whose billion spheres are the Havona spheres? The Trinity's. Okay, see? You'll finally have that ability to complete the process of perfecting that self in a finite way. You know, to be able to finish your ascension career and become a finaliter. And see, so there's this constant interplay between the father and the mother in this whole process of getting you up. You know, the father gets you started, and you work up through the mother, and kind of, you know, and then they're kind of playing together, and then it sort of flips upside down, and you know, and you're constantly playing back and forth. But you know, the interesting thing is sort of like, well, when all is said and done, what do I look like as a finaliter? You know, if someone sees me, they go, "Wow, to see you is to see the Father." No, when you go out as a finaliter, it says you're God revealing. You're not God the Father revealing. You're God the Father seeking, but you're God the Mother revealing when you go out. You're going to show how you responded to the Father's call. Look what I've built because you asked me to, Father. You know? You're going to show people what you've built, how you have encased that which the Father initiated in this magnificent, you know, body of harmony, this mother-like form. The actuality of harmony, the mother. You're going to go out and reveal that. You know, and you literally embody that, like I pointed out, because you can trinitize. You can do that mother trinity-like thing as a finaliter. Can't create, can't do the father thing, but you can trinitize, you can do the mother thing. And literally bringing a being into existence. Okay, so... See, all that, it took us the whole night to just do that one section. But see, it's rich with all this reflection that they wanted you, you know, and how they bring it to an end. This is supposed to be about you, is what they tell you at the end. Now go back and read it again. See, that's why I was spending all this time to bring that out.
if there's no sin, no evil,
yeah,
no error,
right.
Well, then there's still differential in mindal differential.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mind phenomena and personality volition.
Right.
I mean, that's where you can make decisions, where you have to realize differentials and coordinate
right,
things.
Right.
That seems like it's got to be a huge arena because...
One of the keys for you to achieve the such perfect expression that there's no error is lots of helpers. I mean, remember, even on paradise, you have those that engage you about conduct,
right?
Right. You know, and they point out there the one of the very fundamental reasons why you manifest like this so perfectly. Is because you are so perfectly linked into the system. See, what you discover in the end is that no individual in and of themselves has what it takes to do this. It's only when you're part of the cosmic system that you can actually do this. You discover how everything is intimately dependent upon others as you go up. I mean, the Father starts out, you know, starts you out, initiates you, with a good measure of island universe nature, so that, you know, you aren't fundamentally dependent upon that which you can't access yet, because you don't have the mind to bring it in yet. But the more you go up and have the mind to engage more of the whole, the more where you are is dependent upon that whole. You know, to make it to the ends of eternity, you have to be intimately linked to everything. It's not just a matter of, you know, waiting out the clock. I mean, those who are there are connected. You know, you have to be part of the all are to be there. Okay? You know, so you are infinitely dependent there, but also absolutely an individual. That's what's so cool about not being a drop of water in the ocean,
yeah.
Not being that kind of all are, so you can be connected to everything and still maintain your integrity. That's why your personality has an absolute dimension. Only absoluteness can resist being diffused into infinity. if you're going to achieve a relationship at the ends of eternity with infinity, you have to be absolute. Because anything sub-absolute will get diffused into infinity.
But the error is human.
You know, yes, in the normal contrast of human and divine. But to maybe a better way to think about it is to have the potential to one day not err. Now that's truly human.
What?
To be able to never get to this state. That's to truly not be human. That's to be an animal. I mean, if the potential wasn't there, the Father wouldn't have commanded it. Okay, and so we want to remind ourselves of what the word human means. It means you're going up from the humus. Okay, that you're an upward arrow. Yeah, you're not yet without error. But you're not a line segment. You're an arrow. Okay? There's an arrowhead. You're perfecting. One day you will be without error. Okay? And it's because now you're truly human. To see that end now. To see the potential that really makes you worthy to be called human. Don't judge yourself factually. Because that's to debase yourself to an animal. Okay? See yourself truthfully. Right? In truth, you're someone who's going to go through the gates. You're going to pass the test of this experiment. Now, that's the truth of what you are. Yeah, maybe a long time in the future, a lot of steps in between. But in truth, you're a fact that can go through that gate one day. Okay, see yourself for, in that truth light.
And your 12 senses knows it.
And then it's a little easier to deal with that old-fashioned way of, to err is human, to forgive divine. To err is to be of animal origin. That's maybe a less, to err.
Error.
The potential to. Yeah, make an error. A lot of people say to err, but it's technically it's to err.
I keep trying to understand the supreme and rare personality is. So I'm wondering, is that absolute individuality that is that the supremes what exists on the sixth circle of Havona? I keep coming back to this question.
Not so much, but your supreme thing, to think about that in relation to this is if you let go of that gift of absoluteness, even though right now it's the tiniest measure possible, if you let go of that, if you let go of your personality, if you become iniquitous, what happens to the rest of that energy phenomenon, that self? It blends into the supreme. See, because it can't withstand the unity even of supremacy. Supremacy just sucks it right into the unity and diffuses it. See, you will not you won't be able to withstand even the tension of supremacy to diffuse you into as a drop of water in the ocean. Let alone the ultimate or the absolute or the infinite. One day you'll need to be able to stand in the tension of the infinite and not diffuse.
Her absolute individuality, is that what sits on the sixth circuit of Havona?
On the sixth circuit of Havona, you can think of that as the supreme spirit, that unity. Because it exists, that's why if you let go of your personality, you could diffuse into something. The supreme is not just the almighty, the collection of parts, the summation. The supreme is also the mother, the supreme spirit, this unity fact. And that's why if you let go of your nucleating personality, You know, if all there was the Almighty, well, then you would just be another thing rattling around in the container of things, okay? But you don't continue to be this little, you know, you diffuse. Why? Because there's not just the Almighty, there's also the Mother. There's this unity, the Supreme Spirit, that demands that this conform to it. Okay. See, so to think about the, you know, things that last as an individuality in some way have been mastered to the point where they sustain the unity of the Supreme, so they don't diffuse into it. So you know, like you know, you notice that there's the second law of thermodynamics, that you build something and entropy tends to diffuse it back into. Okay, see. We're in a domain where, unless it's been patterned to resist the Supreme, it will obey it and diffuse back into the, you know, the mists. Okay.
The question is, where is the unity of the Supreme, that personality that?
Well, there's two different expressions of it. One is I mean, it's in all of the central universe. It's kind of seated on the sixth circuit.
Okay, I guess that's all I need.
And it's also out here too. The other side of it. The Supreme Spirit is also the finite upholder. Out here is the finite upholder. We don't call it the Supreme Spirit out here. Out here it's the finite upholder. Is something upheld or not? You know, is it ongoing? Okay, or not? You know, if it diffuses away, it's obviously not ongoing. It's not being upheld. It's you know, if it's upheld, it goes on. So out here, you know, see her as the finite upholder, that which maintains what has the requisite integrity. If it conforms to supremacy, she maintains it, upholds it. If it doesn't conform to supremacy, like millions and millions of species, you know, back in the past of the earth, those species cease to exist. They don't conform to the cosmos. They're not maintained, and they diffuse back into the reservoirs from which they were drawn. But some species are maintained. Why? Because they have magical internal integrity? No. It's because they've been patterned to conform to the cosmos, and the finite upholder upholds them, maintains them. Fish are ongoing, because she can feel them. They're like her. Things that aren't ongoing anymore is because they've slipped through her fingers.
What a tragedy that species go out of existence. You hear this. What a tragedy that cultures go out of existence. This is a tragedy on the planet.
All scaffolding will go out of existence. All languages will die. All aboriginal peoples will die. I mean, none of that stuff makes it to light and life, because it's not like the Supreme. It's scaffolding, you know. And the extent to which we try to preserve is the extent to which we will never get to light and life. If you make sure that nothing ever changes, no organic phenomenon is ever allowed to occur, we micromanage everything and rigidly pour epoxy all over it, you can forget about light and life. Okay. You have to let go of it and trust that what needs to be upheld will be upheld. And what needs to fade away needs to fade away. And you need to let it fade away. She knows. She can, you know, she's the selector that we need to trust. All right.
About that dynamic that you described, that we do as our sustaining process, it's so much like something else that we looked at, how the Father separated himself.
He stands, I mean, he gives in every single facet of himself to us and never moves. I mean,
yeah.
Can you imagine?
Right. And you really mean never moves. I mean, if the Father even twitches his eyebrow, everything collapses. He has to be perfectly, absolutely motionless.
His
like the aisle.
His nature is to be like that.
It's
beautiful,
he's
true.
he's at perfect peace in that motionless state.
Exactly.
Right. Let us be at perfect peace in that stillness as well. Let's take a moment to reflect on that.